I'll have what she's having.
Welcome to Our Better Half Podcast, Episode 3, January 24th, 2016. I am Laura Collins Lister-Mensch, the host, and currently snowed in with my mother-in-law, only 2 blocks of good cheese, and luckily a few bottles of wine. Send help, soon. You probably heard the big news. Astronomers in the California Institute of Technology announced Wednesday that they have found new evidence of a giant icy planet lurking in the darkness of our solar system far beyond the orbit of Pluto, and they're calling it Planet 9. But word is, it's actually Planet Clitoris, and of course it was there all the time. Rumors of Clitoris have come up in the past, but they've been dismissed by researchers and hobby astronomers alike. The instruments used were apparently too blunt and not quite sensitive enough. Many astronomers in the lab and in the field have apparently just not seen it, or they didn't recognize it for what it was. In fact, the evidence for its presence has been inferred by strange effects on neighboring bodies that could only be explained by the presence of an important unseen object. The 9th celestial orbiter of our sun has been there waiting, and it's cold. Some say planet Clitoris is cold, even frigid, but there are persistent rumors that it may have a temperate, even tropical climate. Perhaps it remains little known because those who go there stay there, and like a great vacation spot, why tell everybody? It'll just get crowded. Seriously, friends, did you know that the actual anatomy of the human clitoris was not mapped out until the 1990s? That's after everyone over 50 came of age. And I don't seem to remember a headline on this. There were no Nobels or Oscars, certainly. Until recently, I actually hadn't seen the real shape. Have you? It turns out that the female pleasure organ is not a button. It's an iceberg, and it has a really gorgeous shape, like a flying double wishbone or a really cool tuning fork. And it's 90% internal. There's a mixed media art installation called the Clitoracy Project. That's literacy and clitoris in the same word. The creator is a fierce, wise young woman named Sophia Wallace. You'll have to watch her TEDx talk on this. Go do that in about 40 minutes. The link is on the ourbetterhalf.net site. I learned a lot from it, most of which I was chagrined not to have known before. As a literate person with lady parts, I should have known that the clitoris is 7 to 12 centimeters in length. I told you most of it was internal. The term for clitoris, labia, and vagina altogether is vulva, not vagina. That's just the innie part. The clitoris has 8,000 nerve endings. Sorry, penis havers, that's double what you're packing. The clitoris is longer when you get older, 2.5 times bigger after menopause. Some things do get better with age. The plural of clitoris is clitorises or clitorides. And I discovered doing this piece that I pronounce and spell
clitoris
at least 3 different ways. I told you I had things to learn. Now, go to the podcast website and see the very pretty picture of a clitoris made by Wallace. There's also a few artists who make lovely jewelry made with the shape too. Hint, hint, Valentine's Day. No one will ever guess what you're wearing, which is sad, really. But you know now, and that's what matters.
Hi, I'm Charlene Gray, and I'd like to invite you to join me in September for Charlene's Etsy Corner. We'll make all kinds of craft projects, and there'll be a few surprises.
Like me, I'm Randy Bush.
You may have already seen it, but there's an innovative YouTube comedy series called Randy Bush is Back from the Dead, and you have to go check it out. There's a link in the show notes at ourbetterhalf.net. Mindy Glaser wrote for 2 of my favorite U.S. shows, Who's the Boss and Kate and Allie. Here she is. Welcome, Mindy Glaser, a sitcom writer, novelist, poet, teacher, and now an internet entrepreneur. Her YouTube series is called Randy Bush Has Risen from the Dead, and is bringing me with her. And it's now up to 7 episodes on YouTube. Welcome, Mindy.
Thank you, Laura. It's nice to be here.
What did you dream of doing when you grew up?
You know, it's funny. I actually always wanted to be a writer. I didn't really know exactly what that entailed, but my favorite thing was always to listen to a story. My favorite wine as a child was tell me a story. And I think once I read The Diary of Anne Frank, I was 12, and I thought, oh, here's this woman who, you know, who's going to be, who has lived a really unique and interesting life, and everyone is going to know about it. And I thought, that's interesting, just to be able to take your point of view and spread it beyond you. So I didn't know I was going to be a joke writer, but that's okay.
Anne Frank to jokes. It's a natural transition.
if you can't laugh, you know.
Make them cry or make them laugh.
Right. On the same page, preferably.
May I ask how old you are now?
How old am I? I am 64.
And you were a writer for 2 really wonderful American TV series, Who's the Boss? And Kate and Ally, which to me were both about fully formed female characters that were, they were in their parenting and career phase of life.
Right.
And now you're writing for middle-aged women in a very new media.
Yes, which is very challenging.
What's media's role in how we view older women?
I think media shapes how we view older women. They're the butt of jokes. They're befuddled. They're ineffectual. And it's pretty ugly. And it's not surprising when you consider that media now is pretty much run by boys. So, you know. When I was a sitcom writer, there were a few shows, particularly Who's the Boss is one of them, where we had half women and half men on staff. But those shows were very few and far between, and the pendulum has swung back, and now, you know, there are fewer women. But, of course, there are more outlets, so there are women who are going off Jen G. Cohen, you know, and people who are just making their own way, Shonda Rhimes, on television themselves, but it's still very much a male profession. The whole entertainment business is a male profession, which is why we don't get a lot of great female characters, nor a lot of respected female characters. You know, also the economic facts are staggering. This is like, we're like the wealthiest generation of women who exist, you know? They own like $19 billion worth of wealth, and they're inheriting more every day. And they're just being treated like crap. So what's interesting to me is advertisers are jumping all over each other to try and find these people, and they can't. And they can't because mainstream media has made a joke out of them. Now suddenly they want them back. Well, it's not so easy to come back.
And I understand you came to doing your show on YouTube as the result of a class action age discrimination lawsuit.
Partially, yeah. We sued the agencies and the studios for age discrimination because literally the minute you hit 40, you are no longer employable. So a bunch of people got together and we sued, and it took several years. And ultimately they settled, and part of the settlement created something called the Television Writers Fund for the Future, which taught us a number of things. There were many classes available, and one of them was new media, and I just sort of serendipitously found that email and serendipitously said, okay, I'll do that. And I went, and I started to learn about YouTube, which I really had not watched much before, and truth to tell, don't watch enough now. There are too many other things to do. Mm. And as I was watching, as I was in this class, I started just to notice some things about myself that seemed to be changing, that I wasn't that happy about. I seemed to be becoming oddly invisible, which I'm not a really invisible person. You know, I have easily 100 pairs of heels. I used to have a lot more. I remember when they found out Imelda Marcos had all those shoes, I sort of thought, what's the big deal? Like, doesn't everybody, you know? Didn't strike me as odd at all.
Weird.
But I was getting to a point where it's like, I really can't wear them all the time. And, you know, without my high heels, who am I? And so I started to have this identity crisis that I think a lot of women go through at this age. We're very used to being objects of attention from a very early age. You know, from as sort of as soon as you're really sentient, you know, you become an adolescent, you develop breasts, and people look at you. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of it. And suddenly, I mean, I still had the breasts, but nobody cared anymore. You know? So it became very strange to me. And as I was taking this class and the instructor was suggesting, you know, to develop some idea that might take you through 100 episodes of something, I started to think about this. And then I remembered a character I had written in the first pilot I had written, which had gone nowhere. And the character was the wacky neighbor, and her name was Randy Bush, and she was a retired porn star. And she had a mantle full of Dickie Awards. And I thought, well, there's somebody who's probably not going to become invisible, or she would handle it differently than I would. And it sort of all coalesced into this show about a vibrant but dead woman teaching a living but invisible woman about life after a certain age, the benefits, the important things to remember. And it's really about sort of not taking the view of a culture that's discarded you and internalizing it. Because we're really all, in a lot of ways, we are who we are mirrored back as, you know? I think from, you know, as children, you learn to smile, you learn all these things by looking at another face. Mm-hmm. And suddenly there are no faces looking at you. Nobody's making eye contact. You know, does that make you nobody?
Is that the reason we become invisible, because we're seen as less sexual?
Possibly because we're seen as less sexual. One thing Randy says to Charlene early on is that this is the first time you can actually be visible, because before they were just looking at your breasts and your legs and your butt and all of this. But now people have a chance to actually look at you, who you really are. They're not distracted by who you are. And that's something that I've started to realize as well. I may not get the looks that I got, but once I get involved in a conversation with somebody, it's like people realize I'm fascinating. And I think that's something that you don't have, or many people don't have at an earlier age. You know, some people probably were born fascinating, but I wasn't. So there are other ways to actually look at what's going on, you know, and one of them is, as I said, they never saw me to begin with, you know, they saw my cleavage.
Right.
So.
I find it interesting that you created two characters that are both invisible for a different reason, one because she's a ghost and the other because of her age and lifestyle. And here you are making both of them visible to the audience. So how's the audience responding?
You know, I have planned to do, and I don't know, we'll have to see how it goes. I had wanted to do 100 episodes because I know that this is a very steep uphill climb. The audience is small, but it is responding. It surprised me that I have about 40% of the people who are watching are men, which I didn't expect.
Interesting.
I've got a wide age group as well. Most of the people who are watching are women over 50. That's who I've targeted it to. And, you know, when I was doing the class, I got a lot of pushback from a lot of men basically saying, well, I cut out half your audience. It's like, you know what? If you want to watch, fine. I'm not talking to you. Someone else will talk to you. It's not unusual to pick an audience, you know, and to pick a demographic. I have some people who are diehard fans, which is lovely because they're people that they're not my relatives. They're not my friends. They don't know me, but they found me. The hardest thing on the internet is to be heard because there's so much of it. But I just figure that if I persist and I keep putting out what I'm putting out, there is an audience for it, and the audience will find me. There's a tremendous amount of material because I talk about things. I talk about sexuality. I talk about clothes. I talk about style. I talk about spirituality. I talk about history, or herstory, if you will. I talk about female-based religions. There are a billion dead women that Randy has access to. She talked to Eve, you know, and found out the real story in the Garden of Eden, why Eve really ate that apple, or gave Adam the apple. So, and there's a tremendous breadth of positive information and just plain information about aging. And so part of it is I have an entertaining story that is offering information, lifestyle information to people in a way that they sort of don't even realize they're getting it, you know? And I think there are many people doing things like this because we're a big demographic bubble, and I think people are suddenly getting into this, realizing that they can all be on the internet and they can all be, anybody can have their show as long as they have a camera. And I guess I just hope that people will find it, and that once they find it, you know, they'll tell their friends who are about their age. And it will grow.
Do you think that the new media is an opportunity for us to get content for older people?
I think it's a tremendous opportunity. The issue is the noise. You know, as I said, it's just getting through. Also, initially, I think older people were not going to this source for information, but are now. And those numbers are growing. And I think, you know, networks are getting smart about this too. You know, ARP is going to have a network. Mm-hmm. And, so yeah, I think it's great. I think it's great. But again, the challenge is just getting your message across, over all the other messages.
You've got two characters. One is Randy Bush, a former porn actor, now a ghost. You've got Charlene Gray, an Etsy crafter with an unwatched YouTube channel.
Oh, and she's got 24 subscribers.
Is it 24 now? Okay.
I think it might have gone up to 26. But yeah, I mean, she's. We're not sure if they're awake or not, but they may be dead in front of their computers for all we know, as Randy posits. But yeah, she's got 24.
Well, I could ask you which character that you feel you relate to.
Well... let me answer that, okay. Though. A writer relates to all the characters. I'm everybody, you know?
Now, Randy has all the sex appeal, but and you mentioned something before about Randy having things to learn from Charlene. Is that going to be more developed?
Yeah, the original idea was that they were both going to sort of meet in the middle. Charlene is going to make some changes based on Randy, because Randy basically won't go away and won't leave her alone. Randy needs to help Charlene because Randy's done some things that some of which we've actually heard about, but many of which we haven't. And Randy needs to earn her way to a better afterlife. She's at the corner of purgatory and the seventh circle, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
She's in a bad spot, and she is being plagued by some of the worst people who ever lived. And so she does things for Charlene, or she tries to teach Charlene things, and Charlene, as Charlene and the audience potentially, learns things and does things, Randy finds herself in a better place.
You published 7.
Mm-hmm.
You're looking to do 100.
I'd like to do 100. The issue with doing 100 is Charlene can't change too quickly, although she's making some little physical changes, but she can't change too quickly because then there's nowhere to go unless they just sort of both narrowly go on as like Hoda and Kathy Lee of the, you know, the over 50 set, or like Hoda and Kathy Lee probably are over 50. But I have so many ideas. There are so many... Just different. There's so much different information that's positive. And also there are just so many sort of sad, stereotypical things that are foisted on people of this age, that you really would just want to alert people to the fact that these are not absolutes. This is our culture. These are specific people in our culture. As I said, if it's the media, then it's young men. Lots of things are not true that we are made to believe because they are directed at us. And I think it's just really important to maintain them. And I think a lot of people get sort of whittled away because this is what keeps coming at them and coming at them. Or Randy has started tweeting, and it's at the Randy Bush. But she's talking about how, in addition to lots of funny tweets, hopefully, about how survival in and of itself is something to be praised. Most people, most of the time, do not have an easy life. And the fact that we have survived to 50 or 60 or 70 is not a reason for anyone to deride you or to make jokes about you. It means you've accomplished something. You know, it's important, I think. Nobody in this culture says that. And it's important to be reminded, you know, that we've all gone through a hard road. And we should be proud of just being here. Don't call me old, you know, call me enduring.
And celebrate it. I love that. I love it. Right. I have one more question for you.
Okay.
So each episode of this podcast, we're going to take a Kegel break. We're going to exercise our Kegel muscles.
Okay. Shall we do it now?
Strengthen that pelvic floor for better sex. Two questions. One is, what sound would Randy Bush make when she is doing her Kegels?
Randy is a soprano. I wouldn't be able to do the sound, but I would bet she would warble beautifully as a soprano. She has a beautiful voice, which I am hoping we will hear in future episodes. She would make the sounds the angels make.
Oh, my. Okay.
She's aspiring.
And how about Charlene?
Oh, God. Charlene would be going, she would just be totally mortified about the idea of anybody knowing she was doing them.
Well, then she probably needs them more than anybody. Thank you so much. I'm looking forward to pointing people to your episodes.
Thank you. Great. And you can find it at Randy Bush's Back. If you put Randy Bush's Back in the search engine of YouTube and you look at the pictures, we're the ones with the pink marabou feathers. It's pretty obvious who Randy is.
Thank you so much, Mindy.
Thank you. This is lovely, Laura.
It's Kegel break time now. You know the drill. Daily Kegel exercises, great idea for men and women, for good pelvic floor health and happier sex lives, not to mention your sneezophobia. Let's do three together, shall we? One, two, three. Don't forget to do them this week. Think of us. We're cheering you on. Have you ever met a swinger? Someone who, with their partner, enjoys getting together with other couples for sex? Not to worry, I found a nice couple for you to meet. Carol and David. They host the Venus Couples site, which I've linked on the OurBetterHalf.net site. Fair warning, gentle listeners. This conversation includes a word that rhymes with rock and stands for a gentleman's body part about 4 minutes into this interview. So go stand near your fainting chair or turn down your volume.
Carol and David, what did you dream of being when you grew up?
I was going to be a doctor, actually, when I was very young.
I was going to be a baseball player.
Wonderful. So how old are you now?
We are both 52 years old.
Before this conversation, I have only ever met one other person who was a swinger knowingly. So my question for you is, how many would you guess that I've met without knowing?
4% of the population. 4%. Yeah, it's estimated because it's such an underground world. Nobody knows exactly how many swingers there are, but it has been estimated to be about 4% of the population of North America and perhaps more in Europe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Tell me about the term lifestyle.
The lifestyle is used more and more today, which covers a broader range than just swinging. So swingers are part of the lifestyle. Included in the lifestyle are voyeurs, exhibitionists, and different types of swingers like soft swap and full swap swingers.
For those who have absolutely no knowledge of swinging or the lifestyle, could you describe soft swap and hard swap?
Well, first of all, those people who aren't in the lifestyle are, we call them vanilla, a little bit like muggles from Harry Potter.
So vanilla people and swingers are different. And swinging in such a way is that soft swap is everything up to and not including intercourse. And full swap is everything including intercourse.
And for the both of you, how would you describe your personal approach to swinging?
Oh, we love foursomes and moresomes. So the more people in a pile, naked, doing everything is our favorite.
We are full swap couple.
Yes.
And how long have you been doing that?
Probably 8 years, maybe 9 years by now, something like that.
And how long have you been together?
10 years. Our anniversary is coming up this month, 10 years ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
As I've talked to people about these issues, I find that vanilla folks are somewhat fascinated by swingers.
Mm-hmm. You shall agree with
some
that.
Of them, yes.
And they have ideas about what that is. Tell me what it's like to be in that lifestyle, to be swingers, and to hear these impressions. What are the impressions that you hear, and how correct or incorrect are they?
Well, there are a whole list of incorrect impressions that people have of swingers. For example, one could be that the man forces the woman into the swinging lifestyle, to wife swap, that kind of thing. It's really not that at all.
Yeah, it's definitely not the place to go to fix a broken relationship. You have to be a super strong couple to be a swinger or in the lifestyle.
Some other people think that if you are standing beside a swinger, they might jump on you or want to have sex with you because, of course, they think we have sex with everybody and anything that moves, which, of course, is not true.
And I guess one of the biggest misconceptions, which is reality in the lifestyle, is woman drives. It's a very female-centric environment and community where the woman has her foot on the gas or on the brake, and it's the guy who actually follows.
Actually, I was going to ask you about that because I will confess that I grew up thinking that swinging was a thing that guys came up with to enjoy sex outside the marriage and that women went along with it to keep the guy happy. But on your site, you describe swinging as sexy fun and designed for the woman, which goes to what you just said. Could you speak more about that? Why?
The woman is the one who makes all the decisions about play or no play. And I guess it's really because the guy's going to probably play with whoever she says yes. So I guess if you have to have somebody who is in control, it's the woman who's in control. One of the things about our website which differentiates it from other types of sexual websites is that our website is designed for the woman. Some other websites allow different things. So in our website, we don't allow nudity. And I like to say that I don't like to talk to the cock. So in photos online, we allow that to be present because the woman, she doesn't need to see somebody else's cock first off. She wants to first meet the person, that if she has a connection. And then later, if they are going to see each other naked, either they can share private photos or meet. And if that's the case and it all works out, we're all great.
And most couples in the lifestyle, whatever they do, it's to strengthen their couple. So the experience, the going out, the events, the vacations are normally done together as a couple. You know, you decide together where you want to go. You decide which couples you want to meet. But in the end, if there's, you know, a discrepancy, no one ever takes one for the team. But it's the woman who actually has, we'll call it the hammer. And if she's not good with it and he might be good with it, it just doesn't happen.
That's interesting. Can you talk about the demographics of the swingers that you encounter in terms of ethnicity, economic status?
Okay, yes, definitely. So first of all, economic status. Well, in general, there are people in the swinging lifestyle from all walks of life. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to say for all different economic statuses. Mm-hmm. We can be naked in the hot tub and sitting beside a billionaire and you would never know it. You're just sitting there chatting on a level basis. He probably would have no clothes on, so you're not going to see his Cartier watch or his Rolex or his Ferrari. It's just a really level playing field. There are a lot of people in the lifestyle who are in public service, including policemen, nurses, teachers, that kind of thing. And it might be because they're used to being dealing with other people. Maybe they're not shy. Not really sure why, but there are really a lot of people in the public service industry.
Mm-hmm.
High profile lawyers, professionals, all sorts. So from every walk of life, you will see people in the lifestyle.
And there are also people in the lifestyle who might only do it once a year or twice a year because that's their little treat. And they might save up on it, save up their money to do a weekend away or a vacation away or a house party or a hotel party. And that's all they do. And there's others who do it twice a week. So, you know, it varies based on what's good for your couple, what's good for your finances. And, you know, life is busy. So you fit it into what works best for you as a couple.
And in general, the lifestyle in North America is from about 35 to probably 55 or 60 is the average group of lifestyle people in North America. There are other countries where they start younger, where they're exploring sexuality at a younger age. But I would say in North America, the average age is about 45.
That was actually my next question, was to talk about the age issue. Would you say that how much of the swinging culture is about being young and in appearance and having perfect young bodies?
It's not about that at all.
No,
it's really about feeling younger. I mean, you kind of get back that sexual feeling you had when you were in your early 20s, which does dissipate a little bit when you get married and have kids and you're bogged down being a mom and a dad and catering to your children. A lot of couples go into the lifestyle after their kids are old enough to look after themselves, where they can get away for evening, weekend, or a trip away if they can. And they rediscover their couple again and makes you feel young because you remember that horny feeling you had in your 20s and all the sex you had back then. So it makes you feel younger, but it's not about having a young body.
And there are compatible couples for every type of person, body type, color,
attitude.
Race, attitude, age. So, you know, we have some friends who are in their 70s, as we have some friends who are in their 30s. And it's such an easygoing, non-judgmental group of people that one night you can be with this type of group, and next weekend you can be with a completely different group of people. But there's compatible couples for anybody who wants to do something in the lifestyle.
Would you say that there is any ageism?
Not really.
I would say probably the ageism would be in the older group, would tend to stay with the older group.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't mean that young couples don't want to be in their 30s, be with 50-year-olds. It doesn't mean that, but
mm-hmm.
the pace is similar, their attitudes are similar. There's a lot of friendships that develop afterwards. So, you know, you would be more probably apt to be connecting easier with people who your own age.
And at the same stage in life. However, you know, we've friends and we've played with couples who are in their 30s. And, you know, we have this rule, which is half your age plus 7. We can't go younger than that.
Right.
So that keeps us in line.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, that's 33. So 33 is our lower limit. Some people have their lower limit as the age of their eldest child. My eldest child is 24, so I definitely don't want to be playing with anybody under 24, but we actually stick to the rule of half your age.
Oh, that's interesting. Talk about safe sex.
Safe sex in general is practiced in the lifestyle without question. It's not necessarily something you have to ask somebody. There's a lot of things you do ask. What are your rules and what do you like and what you don't like? In general, the safe sex is always out there. So and we know it's only safer sex, right? There's no absolute safe sex out there. And in general, condoms are used for penetration, not necessarily used for oral sex. So some people might not agree with that, but that's in general how it goes.
What's the etiquette of working out those boundaries?
You ask.
Yeah, that's it. You ask the question.
What are your rules?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you meet a couple, it's not really like singles dating where you're going to a bar and you want to meet this person who you're going to fall in love with and you're going to spend the rest of your life with. Most lifestyle couple or swinger couples, when they're getting together, there's one you know, goal in mind, and it's to, you know, have sex later. Yeah. So, you know, you start off and you want to know, you know, there's questions about, you know, is the woman more into women or into men? You know, do you guys use condoms or don't you use condoms?
Same room or different room?
Same room or different room. And are you full swap or soft swap? And those questions are just part of the natural getting to know the other couple versus if you were a single dating and you'd say, oh, you know, where's your family from and how many and do you want to have kids and where do you want to live and where did you go to school? It's a very, very different conversation when you're dating another couple.
And do you see the same couples over and over, or is novelty a big part of it?
Both.
Both. We would say novelty is a big part of the lifestyle. It is fun, but we do develop friendships in the lifestyle, and we do like to see often same people over and over, but we also travel a lot and meet new people all the time.
And then we have our good group of friends who are always introducing us to some of their new friends. So, you know, the circle of swingers and lifestyle friends gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And then every once in a while, we meet people who are vanilla twist. So they know about swinging. They want to know more about swinging. And they ask a lot of questions. And every once in a while, they dip their toes in. And some of them like it. And others decide, no, that's not for us.
What do you tell your unswinging friends and relatives and your dentist?
Well, we're actually one of the very few couples who are out in the open, and it's mostly because we have this dating site, and we do talk on the radio at conventions, and we do answer any questions that are out there if people want to know. But so our friends and family do know we're swingers, but the truth of the matter is they don't ask very many questions at all. Our kids know, our parents know, brothers and sisters, nobody asks us anything. The finger in the ear, la, 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 la kind of thing, you know?
Does being public about it, or being in the swinging lifestyle, does it somewhat put you outside of society? Because it's a small percentage of people. Do you feel marginalized in any way?
At this moment, no, we have not had any experience like that. So up till now, no. I know there are most, 99% probably, of swingers are underground. Mm-hmm. So have not had any negative feedback from telling our friends and family. We weren't sure when we went ahead and told them 3 years ago, but we know that we did not lose one friend and we did not lose one family member as a result of us being open about our lifestyle.
I guess on the other side, when we do tell people we're swingers, inquiring minds want to know. So they do ask some questions that, you know, are very vanilla, gentle, general. And sometimes, you know, it's like, okay, I don't need to know anymore. And others are like, well, tell me a little bit more. So, you know, it's like, you know, when you're in a couple and you want to approach your partner about having a threesome, but you're not going to ask her because, you know, you think you're afraid of rejection. And then 10 years later, you know, you have this discussion and she says, you know, 10 years ago, I really was thinking about us having a threesome, but you guys never talk about it together because it's not something a monogamous couple would bring into their bedroom.
Mm-hmm. What's the role of alcohol and drugs in the swinging lifestyle?
Well, we had just had that discussion this week, past weekend. We were in Florida and we were at one of the nicest swinger clubs in North America in Fort Lauderdale. And our friends, who we were very clear with, we just mentioned, well, listen, we don't drink very much, maybe one or two glasses of wine throughout the evening, because we want to enjoy
and remember
every detail. That's what keeps us going in between, kind of thing, you know. So we relive the experiences over and over in our minds, and it helps us to have a great sex life together. So we don't want to forget anything, and we want to enjoy every single bit of it. So we actually don't use any drugs at all, but we will have a glass of wine or a glass of beer while we're entertaining with our friends.
And definitely, you know, if you're at a house party or you're at an event and, you know, people are getting sexy and getting ready to play and party 3, 4, 5 couples at a time, nobody wants a drunk person in that mix. Because it just doesn't become fun, and the person just messes up everything. So, you know, drunkenness and drugs and where you're not coherent is not something we see very often at all, because it just takes the fun out of the whole experience.
Hmm. So aside from being naked, what's the dress code?
Sexy.
Super sexy.
It's really, the dress code is sexy until you start having sex. Then you take it all off, obviously. But high heels, short skirts, plunging necklines, revealing, see-through, sheer, that kind of thing. And it's usually the girls who dress up. The guys wear something sharp, nice, good-looking, not necessarily sexy, but usually a shirt or a polo shirt with a nice pair of jeans. That's just fine.
Yeah, part of the lifestyle is living sexy, wearing things you couldn't normally wear to your local coffee shop, to your Starbucks in the morning. There's a very big difference between nudists and swingers or lifestylers, because swingers don't do everything naked. They do everything very sexy. And if we go to a party, everybody comes dressed mega sexy, mega sensual. And part of the evening is about, it's not a fashion show, but what is each woman wearing, and how part of the evening sometimes is a theme. So you might have a leather and lace or a white party, and it makes the feeling and the sensualness of the evening so much sexier than everybody just being there naked.
When you go to a nudist event, it's not about sex. When you go to a swinger event, it's not about being nude.
That's right. You got it.
Yeah, we don't go to nudist events. We go to clothing optional beaches and clothing optional resorts where, you know, during the day you're on the beach or at the pool naked, but as soon as the evening rolls around, all the women get dressed up, so much so that you'd be sitting next to someone at the pool chatting with them during the day, and you meet them at night and it's like, is that really you? Because the transformation into the sexiness and the hair and the makeup is just spectacular.
But you're adventurous sexually, obviously. Are you adventurous in other ways? I mean, do the two go together? Do you eat strange foods? Do you?
Strange foods. We have a very basic appetite for food, very open to anything that's going on, but we're just very, very basic eaters. We like to travel, so we are very adventurous in meeting new people at all, any chance we get. So I guess you could say we're gregarious type people, open-minded, and we love to see new things.
But we do live sexy. You know, we'll go shopping at the shopping center and have a little quickie in the changing room.
One of the hashtags that I saw that you use is my best friend. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
I guess we believe the couples, that the strongest couples who really enjoy the lifestyle the best, really treat their partner as their best friend in the adventure of sex, in the adventure of life, in sharing things and enjoying things. That's what it's all about. It's about having your best friend with you during those adventures.
Yeah, like I said earlier, for us, the lifestyle is about strengthening our couple. We'll never go into any situation where we're not comfortable, where it's not going to be fun for us, and where we're not going to come out and say, you know what, we had a great evening and our couple is stronger. And we sometimes go to events that we don't play with anybody because it's just not right. It's not the right field and right this. And sometimes we just want to have great sex, the two of us, in an adventurous, sexy environment.
Mm-hmm. On your website and in this discussion, we've been talking about heterosexual couples.
Yes, we deal only with, well, we only know heterosexual couples in the lifestyle. In fact, if there are gay couples in the lifestyle, which I'm not even going to answer, if I don't know the answer to that. So therefore, there's nothing about gay couples or homosexual couples in the lifestyle because I'm unaware of them.
What can not swingers learn from swingers?
I guess the main things that we think we like to say we have an advantage over other couples is that we have good communication skills. The lifestyle forces the couples to talk about what they're planning to do, to talk about it while they're doing it, and to talk about it afterwards. We love the recap of what we liked and what we didn't like at the end of every night, usually in the car on the way home. We usually list things that we really enjoyed, and then we list the things that we might change for next time. And that way we're having good communication skills. And I'll tell you, it really helps in all aspects of your life if you can talk about what you liked in sex and what you didn't like.
Yeah, and on the next point, trust and honesty. You really have to have a strong bond with your partner, trusting them, going into a situation where there's lots of people, there's going to be lots of sex with other people, and you need to trust that both of you are...
that both of you will follow the rules.
Follow the rules that,
you've
that
established.
The two of us have established. Yes. Mm-hmm. Honesty, you know, we come home and did you like this? Didn't you like that? Well, I would have preferred if you didn't do that. And that communication, trust, honesty, and being best friends is probably the top three non-negotiables and things that you learn continuously in the lifestyle that is probably very different than some couples who are monogamous because, you know, probably the communication isn't that great. And sometimes they keep secrets from each other because they don't want to be told no or no, are you crazy? I don't want to do that. What Carol was saying, communication, trust, honesty, being best friends is what it's all about.
You're both a little bit over 50 now.
Mm-hmm.
What do you envision for your future in terms of swinging?
We hope we never have to stop swinging. So it's something we like. We feel it's part of us now. I don't think either of us could go back to being monogamous. So the way we feel now, we hope it continues like this forever.
So is there anything else that you think, especially our audience, over 50 people, would need to know about your lifestyle?
Well, I guess not everybody, of course. It doesn't work for everybody because sharing your partner is something that you have to have, a lot of trust with. So it's not that it works for everybody. However, even couples that don't want to be swingers can learn the lessons of the good communication and maybe just watching pornography and not necessarily sharing their partners. Those are the kind of things that can help your sex life. And I think, I truly believe that the stronger your bond in bed, the stronger your bond in general.
And there are lots of ways for couples over 50 to rejuvenate and re-excite themselves without having to play with other couples. And like Carol was saying earlier, part of the lifestyle is being a voyeur or being an exhibitionist. So we have friends and we know couples who don't play with anybody else and don't do anything with anybody else, but they'll go to a club and have great sex between the two of them with people watching them. Or they'll go and hold each other and watch other people having sex. We have friends who we go on vacation with who are very turned on by just having sex next to another couple having sex. So you're not touching or kissing or doing anything. You're just in a very sexy and erotic environment that's spicing up your own sex life. And we won't even get into talking about toys and how that enhances your sex life and sexuality as well over 50.
I want to thank you both for being here.
You're welcome. Our pleasure.
Thanks so much and good luck.
You other kids all across the land, take it from me. Parents just don't understand.
Welcome to this week's Explain That to a Grandma segment. Today we have Sydney and Grandma Carly. Welcome.
Hi, Grandma Carly.
Hey, as George Tucky says, oh my, talking to your young people about sex.
So Sydney, what do you want to describe to Grandma Carly today?
I have chosen the term shrimping.
Shrimping?
Yes. So do you understand what shrimping is, Grandma?
In a sexual context or just...
Yeah. Do you know what it means?
No,
okay.
I don't.
So shrimping is when either you or your sexual partner enjoy oral fixation of the feet or toes. For some people, it
feet or
feels
toes.
Really good. Yeah.
Okay, so now I know.
Yeah. Do you have any questions?
About it?
Yeah, I mean... Kind of weird, right?
Yes. Well, it's not weird. I've heard of it. I mean, I know that people do that.
Yeah.
I've heard of it. I think I've even probably seen it in a movie or read about it.
Yeah.
To each their own.
Yeah. I've never had like a friend or anyone else like describe that to me. I just know what it is.
Well, yeah, I think I'm very clear on what that is.
All right.
And I guess you would just have to have some clean feet.
Oh, gosh. I guess you do, don't you?
Thank you, Sydney, and thank you, Grandma Carly.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Of course. Kids all across the way. Take it from me. Parents just don't understand.
I've been through the mill of love. Oh, love.
We have Alberta Knish, our senior correspondent of Ancient Erotica for the podcast. How are you?
I'm really well today. How are you?
Very well. What do you have for us today?
I have something that's very, very fun. And it actually has to do with the work of Jane Austen, which I assume most people are at least familiar with. Jane Austen wrote about Regency England, which she was writing between 1809 to 1818. She unfortunately died very young. Persuasion was her last completed book. And she wrote about upper middle class British society. So this seems like an unlikely topic, but a woman named Melanie Erin Osborne from Rollins College did a master's thesis called The Bitter Relics of My Flame, The Embodiment of Venereal Disease and Prostitution in the Novels of Jane Austen.
Oh, do go on.
In Regency society, Jane Austen is writing predominantly about the landed gentry class. The lord of the manor had license to do pretty much as they chose. In many of her books, her villains are sexually promiscuous men. I mean, she's acknowledging that this happens and it's looked down upon, and the consequences for men and women are very different. You know, the lord of the manor could sleep with his servants. He could have affairs, and there really wasn't a lot that they could do. The women, his wife, had to pretend she didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But at this time in England, there are some public health estimates that perhaps as many as a third of people living in Britain at that time had syphilis.
A third.
It was very rampant. It was something people died of. This was 100 years before penicillin. It had consequences. So what happened was society, polite society, evolved to help everybody keep the pretense up. So she writes about people have beauty marks and facial ornaments, and these patches were to cover up end-stage syphilis sores as they appeared on your face.
Ew.
I know, but they were fancy. They were often, you know, if you were really wealthy, they could be bejeweled, and you stuck them all over the sores, and everybody said, I just love your face pack. And then the other thing that was done, how syphilis was treated was with a mercury treatment. It's very, very toxic. It probably worked to kill the actual syphilis virus, but it killed everything else. And the consequence of this treatment was that it makes your teeth fall out. So what the upper classes would do was pay poor people for their teeth. And in Persuasion, her last novel, there is a character, Mrs. Clay, who is a poor widow who is trying to finagle her way into being the second Lady Elliot. Jane Austen writes several times about Mrs. Clay's protruding tooth. So the implication is that Mrs. Clay has had this procedure and paid some poor person who probably was STD positive themselves for their tooth, to replace the one that she lost undergoing treatment for something her husband wound up giving her.
All right. Everybody's pulling out their Jane Austen and rereading with a whole new view.
I certainly have been.
This is great. Okay. So we'll have a link in the show notes to this, and I hope everyone will check it out and we'll be discussing it online. Thank you very, very much.
You're welcome.
Who gets upgraded to sex over 50 this week? Shaba Ranks, Jamaican singer. He can now have sex over 50. His countryman, Desmond John Ballantyne, better known as Ninja Man, a Jamaican dance hall DJ and actor, is eligible for over 50 sex now and is conveniently out on bail awaiting trial for a murder. Tariq Al-Ali, Kuwaiti comedian and actor. Dana Conrad Heitman, ska band trumpeter. Guy Delisle, cartoonist and animator from Quebec City. Rainn Wilson, actor better known for his role as Dwight Schrute in the US TV series The Office, is doing it over 50 now. Bill Maher, the TV show host and evangelistic atheist, will be doing it over 60 starting this week, but will presumably not be saying, oh God, in the throes. The Mensa member and actor Gina Davis achieved 60 this week. No word on what she calls out, but it probably has several syllables. Country singer Dolly Parton will begin having sex over 70 this week. No, my friends, not with you. Jerry Kramer, Green Bay Packer, still not a Pro Football Hall of Famer, but is still now able to have sex over 80. Able to have sex over 90 this week, the science fiction novelist Catherine MacLane, whose story The Kidnapping of Baroness Five described a world where attempts to extend human lifespan went wrong, and the world descends into a feudal state as generations grow shorter and the wisdom of age is no longer passed down. In the next episodes, we will be celebrating Valentine's Day by hearing from people who aren't sexual, aren't partnered, aren't missing it. We'll talk about sex and fat, explore masturbation for those who have not yet had an orgasm, and a lady who sold sex toys at private parties for a decade. We're also going to talk about hair down there. Say, if you're someone way under 50 who would like to appear on our Explain That to a Grandma segment, drop me a line. And if you're a grandma who'd like to learn about some crazy thing the young people are up to, send a messenger pigeon. We'd love to have you on the show. And if you're over 50 and you have a story to tell, something inspiring or surprising or fun, let me know. I'm all ears. For the links and people discussed in this podcast, visit our website at ourbetterhalf.net. Don't forget to subscribe by putting your email in the form on the site or through iTunes or your favorite podcasting app. Now, it's time to go. If you've neglected to have an orgasm yet today, old people, get on that. It's good for your skin and sleep and your smile. Catch you next week.